Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us today. My name is Susie Gelman, and I'm privileged to serve as the board chair of Israel Policy Forum. If you're joining Israel Policy Forum for the first time today, I want to welcome you. And if you are a returning viewer, I want to welcome you back. And I also want to wish everyone a happy and healthy new year. For those who are new to us, Israel Policy Forum works to educate policymakers, Jewish community leaders, and leaders of the next generation to be informed and effective in their support of U.S. efforts to advance a viable two-state outcome to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict consistent with Israel's security. If you made a gift to Israel Policy Forum in 2020, thank you very much. This is just one example of the impact you had on our shared commitment to advancing the vision of a Jewish, democratic, and secure Israel. In this transitional moment, our regular Tuesday video briefings continue to be a source of credible, nuanced analysis, not just for today's listeners and supporters, but also for policymakers in Washington and for community leaders across the political, denominational, and generational spectrums, individuals who downloaded these briefings more than 30,000 times last year. When you make a gift in 2021, you'll help support not just the Tuesday webinars, but also the weekly Koplo column, Israel Policy Pod, community programming, policy briefings for the Biden administration and the 117th Congress, and development of the next generation of leaders and policymakers. Visit israelpolicyforum.org/giving and make your 2021 gift today. Thank you. Now on to today's program. Israel is now officially headed to yet another Knesset election for an unprecedented fourth time in 2 years. Israelis will cast their ballots on March 23rd, just 2.5 months from now. We've already witnessed the creation of several new political parties, while polls project some existing factions could miss the electoral threshold. To help us make sense of the emerging political landscape, we're indeed fortunate to be joined by Barak Ravid. Barak is a contributing correspondent at Axios and is a diplomatic correspondent for Walla News. With that, Barak, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here again. It's great to see that so many people are interested with what I have to say. It's really, I got to say, it's really touching to see that almost 300 people decided to take a break in their day to listen to me. And so I thank everybody here, and I'm ready to take all your questions.
Yofi. All right, let's get started. As I mentioned in my opening remarks, this election campaign has already seen the launch of several new parties. Could you share a little bit about who these newcomers are and where they fit into Israeli politics?
Oh, wow. That's, you know, in I mean, when you try to explain such a thing to Americans who are used to a two-party system, it is very, very hard to start explaining, especially in this particular election. Because basically right now, I think we almost at the point that we have more parties running in the elections than actual voters. It's really, you know, it's, I think it's moving faster than COVID, the pace of forming new parties. Every day I get a new press release to my inbox telling me about a new party. Just today I got one press release about the retired retired citizens party that is being formed by the former head of Mossad, who's now a retired person. You know, he's opening a new party. Just a few minutes ago, there was a news story about the fact that Moshe Yaalon, the former chief of staff who was in Likud, minister of defense, and then in blue and white, and then with Yair Lapid, and now he's contemplating running on his own party. And just a few minutes ago on one of the TV channels in Israel, there was a poll, a new public opinion poll about the elections. And I think they polled something like 15 parties. okay, which is just completely crazy. So we have, so I'll just give you the main names that decided they're going to run again. Obviously, I think the most interesting player in these elections will be Gideon Saar, former minister of Likud, minister of Interior, minister of Education, who decided to leave Likud to break with Netanyahu. Saar was always an internal opposition to Netanyahu from within Likud. He ran against him in the primaries more than a year ago. He lost. And since then, he was an outcast within Likud. And I think it was 3 weeks ago. It just seems everything seems so. It becomes hard to keep track. But I think it was 3 weeks ago that he announced that he's forming his own party called it New Hope, which will be basically, if I need to simplify what this party is about, it's basically the Likud without the corruption, without the incitement, and without Sarah Netanyahu. That's basically the party, which is based on, you know, very conservative politicians and party members. If you will, this party is very reminding of, if I'm trying to give you an example from your politics, it's like the Never Trumpers in the Republican Party would form a party. That's basically it. Take Mitt Romney, Bill Kristol. Those are the types, but just the Israeli version of them. So very conservative, very right wing, but at least people who are still committed to the rules of the game, to the rule of law, to not trying to recalculate the votes of the election after the election. But very, very, but again, very, very conservative. And according to the polls, Gideon Saar right now is the second largest party after Likud. He gets between 18 to 20 seats. And in every speech he gave since he formed his party, he said, if you expect me to sit in the same government under Netanyahu as prime minister, don't vote for me. So he's very clear on the point that he is not going to join any government that Netanyahu is forming. A warning here, Benny Gantz said the same thing. He's sitting with Netanyahu for the last 6 months, and from a party with 35 seats in the poll today, he's only with 5 seats after sitting with Netanyahu 6 months in the government. Amir Peres, the chairman of the leader party, that right now doesn't pass the threshold. It's amazing. The Labour Party, the party that formed this country, does not pass the threshold. It got only like 1.5% in the poll today, and the threshold is 3.25. Amazing. So Amir Peretz, the chairman of the Labour Party, was known for his extravagant mustache. Before the last election, he shaved his mustache as a sign that he will not. He will not sit with Netanyahu in the same government. Surprise, surprise! Amir Peretz is the minister of the economy in Netanyahu's government. So you have to take all those statements before the elections that we will not sit with Netanyahu with not a grain of salt, but with 3 tons of salt. So this is Gideon Saar, and we can talk about him again later if you want. So this is one party. Another party, which is very interesting, is Ron Huldai's party. The mayor of Tel Aviv decided to form a party. And here also there are some similarities to your politics, because Ron Huldai is basically Michael Bloomberg. He's a very well-respected mayor, other than the fact that he's still a sitting mayor. But he's very well-respected. He's very well-liked. But Michael Bloomberg, his base is New York. And Ron Huldai's base is Tel Aviv, and maybe some of the suburbs of Tel Aviv. And he started, when he announced his party, he got 8 seats in the polls. Today he's already at 6 seats. So it's his party is basically some he managed to get some of the voters that used to vote for blue and white and now are going to vote for him. Another new party is actually an old party, and this is blue and white, because it used to be a party that was formed by Benny Gantz's party, Yair Lapid's party, and Moshe Yaalon's party. And it used to be a party that was supposed to be the ruling party of the country. It got, in the first election campaign, it got 35 seats. The second election campaign, it got 33. And in the third election campaign, it also got 33. And right now, they're only on 5 after Benny Gantz dismantled his party when he entered the government with Netanyahu. He, from 33, he only entered the government with 17. Members of Knesset. And since then, he went down in the polls. In the last 3 weeks, I think 11 members of his party announced that they're leaving and resigned from either the government or the Knesset. The latest one was the minister, Merav Cohen, the minister for community equality. Yes, we have a ministry like that in this country, which is completely bizarre, but it actually exists. But she told Gantz today that she's leaving, and she just joined Yair Lapid. They had a press conference, 30 minutes ago. So his party basically dismantled. And now it's a whole new party with a much more, from a, let's say, a center-left party, it is now a center-right party, because all the members who stayed within this party are the ones that are very much leaning to the right. I'm entering a remark here just because someone told me that some of the things I said might not be totally clear. When I said the threshold, it means the number of votes a party needs to get in order to enter the Knesset. And today the threshold is 3.25% of the votes, which is more or less equivalent to 120,000, 150,000 votes. And it's equivalent to 4 seats in the Knesset. So basically, the smallest party you can have in the Knesset is 4 seats. Just a comment here. So a big question mark is what Benny Gantz is going to do. We have until February 5th, I think, when the lists to the Knesset are closed, that this is the last deadline for applying as a candidate to the Knesset. And until then, we'll have to see what Benny Gantz does. Because if he continues, at least for now, publicly he says, I'm running until the end, but as the race continues and as February 5th gets nearer, we will see that all of those parties are, which most of them are in the anti-Netanyahu bloc, they will have to somehow unite. Because if all those parties will stay as, you know, small parties, many of them will not pass the threshold and many votes will go to waste. I'll give you another example. Yair Lapid had his closest friend and ally, personal friend, was Ofer Shelach, member of Knesset. Ofer Shelach announced several weeks ago that he's leaving Yair Lapid's party, and it was over basically a personal issue between them and some ideological issues too. And Ofer Shelach thought that when he leaves Yair Lapid, he will become this new political meteor. It didn't happen. In the poll today, Ofer Shelach got, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 0.8%. 0.8%, which is just very embarrassing. And obviously, he will not run on his own too. He is trying also to make some sort of unification with somebody else. And you have another party headed by the economist Professor Yaron Zalicha, who formed a party that is called the Economy Party, which is, by the way, very surprising in the poll today, he got 2.8%, okay, to his party, which is pretty amazing because Yaron Zalicha is not a household name in Israel. But the fact that there's a party that talks only about the economy, apparently it's appealing to a lot of people. And 2.8% basically means that he's an asset to many, many other parties because he has a base and he has a constituency and he brings voters. So, and all of those people are in the anti-Netanyahu camp. So until February 5th, there is a potential that we will see all of those small bits and pieces of parties coming together either to one big party or to several medium-sized parties. If that doesn't happen, then it means that many, many votes will just go to waste.
Thanks, Barak, for sort of laying some of the foundation in terms of explaining some of these different parties and what's going on. And by the way,
you know, Susie, I'm not under any illusion that I made things clearer because
I just was wondering if you're going to start a journalist party. By the way,
you know, there used to be many journalists in Israeli politics. Actually, still, you know, Yair Lapid is a former journalist. Ofer Shelach is a former journalist. Shelly Yachimovich was a journalist. Now she was a journalist, became a politician. Now she's back in journalism. So, but I'm not contemplating any such thing. I'm not crazy. I'm not suicidal.
Well, if you do decide to announce, I hope you'll let Israel Policy Forum get the scoop. You talked about Benny Gantz and Kohol Levan and basically how it's plummeted in the polls since really very, you know, being the largest party in the last three elections, right? So how has Gantz's decline impacted the credibility of the Israeli opposition in general?
The Israeli opposition is in a huge crisis. The fact that between 10 and 15 seats of center-left voters that voted in the last three elections to Benny Gantz are voting now for Gideon Saar and even for Naftali Bennett. Okay? It is sheer madness. But it also tells you something, because it's also something very similar to your politics. Just think about Georgia, okay? The fact that Joe Biden won in Georgia is because some Republicans decided to vote for Biden. Not because they suddenly became progressive liberals, but because they wanted to kick Donald Trump out. And in Arizona, I guess the same thing happened. And I guess it happened in other parts of the country, because you can see the difference between how people voted for Congress and how people voted for the president. And here it's the same thing, but the other way around, that center-left voters, the main thing they want to achieve in this election is to try and kick Netanyahu out. And for that, they're willing to vote for anybody who says that he's not going to sit with Netanyahu in the same government. And this is why you see Gideon Saar in the polls with 17, 18, sometimes even 20 seats. And this is why you also see Bennett getting some center-left votes, because he also said that he's running for prime minister. So people are still thinking that he might not sit with Netanyahu, although my personal opinion, there's no chance that Bennett is not going to sit with Netanyahu, sit under Netanyahu as prime minister. Again, this tells you that this center-left camp that managed just a year ago, to get 65 seats, the majority, to have the majority, is completely disintegrated. It is disoriented, leaderless, and in a very, very, very deep crisis. Hmm.
So let's now switch back to Gideon Saar, his new Tikva Chadasha party, and of course, other right-wing challengers. What is the growth of the right and the marginalization of the left that you were just describing mean for the future of Israeli politics? What obstacles are preventing a center-left Party from replicating the success of labor in the 1990s or Kadima 10 years later?
I think it's a lot of it is about leadership. Look, in the current elections, this is not a classic left and right election. Okay? No one is debating anymore the future of the West Bank. Nobody, on the other hand, no one's talking about annexation anymore. It's clear that this thing is dead. So all those issues are not the main issues. And this is, again, this is an opportunity for the center-left in Israel, because people are voting on COVID, people are voting on the economy, people are voting on rule of law and corruption. So this gives a lot of opportunities. But at this current time, because of the fact that blue and white fell apart after Gantz joined Netanyahu's government, there is, I think, not only disappointment, but almost despair among many center-left voters. I don't think, by the way, that, in the last 6 months, it's not like many right-wing voters were born and many left-wing voters died. The situation stayed more or less the same. The only thing is that Netanyahu has a very strong base that even, you know, in the last elections, he got 36 seats. Now in the polls, he's at 27, 28. So he got hit, okay? But still, he has a base that nobody thinks that Netanyahu will go down from 27, 26. You know, this is his base, okay? And the ultra-Orthodox, they have their base too. There will always be at, 15, 16, 17, something like that. And then you have all the rest, because the ultra-Orthodox are with the pro-BB camp no matter what. In this camp right now, the only people who are at least perceived as credible leaders are people from the right. And it's pretty amazing that this election, unless something will happen by February 5th, and we will see some sort of a unification in the center left, then if it's not going to happen, then the election will be only on the right. Not the center left will be, a minor player.
Turning back to Ron Huldai for a moment, you described him as being the equivalent of Michael Bloomberg. He's a very popular longtime mayor of Tel Aviv, and you talked about how that's really where his constituency is. He also has been a longtime stalwart of the Labor Party. Is he seeking to fill the void left by Labor, or is he trying to chart a different course?
I don't know. He could have taken the Labor Party walking, but he didn't want to have anything to do with this brand. The Labor Party brand is it's dead. So he wanted to form his own party. And I think he was betting on trying to run head-to-head with Yair Lapid and at a certain point to be the bigger party. And then to unite with Lapid, but with Lapid as number two. And right now, this plan is not working. And the best thing he could hope for is to join Lapid as number two. And if this will happen, then you suddenly are going to have a party with more than 20 seats on the center left, which will look a bit more like a party that has any ambitions to take the prime minister's office.
Barak, please tell us a little bit about what's happening with the joint list. Its numbers have slipped in the polls, and there are concerns it could dissolve over the budding relationship between Prime Minister Netanyahu and Mansour Abbas, who leads Ra'am, one of the joint list's constituent parties. What will happen if the joint list splits or shrinks further?
Yeah, I just wrote a story about this that will run tomorrow on my newsletter on Axios about, I call the story Netanyahu's Arab Spring. because what we see in what we saw in every election since 2015 is that Netanyahu focused his campaign on inflammatory rhetoric and racist incitement against the Arab politicians and Arab voters. In 2015, you remember that he said that they're coming in droves to vote, that left-wing organizations are driving them in buses to the polling stations. And it actually worked for him because he managed to rally his base through this racist incitement. In 2019 and in 2020, in the three election campaigns, he also campaigned against the joint list and against any attempt to use the support of the joint list to form an alternative government. He called them terrorist supporters, et cetera. And in 2015 and in 2020, in the third election campaign, what it actually did is that Netanyahu's incitement campaign actually backfired. And Arab voters came to vote in the highest numbers ever. The turnout in the Arab community was at 65% in the last election, which got the joint list to 15 seats, the highest number ever. And basically what the Arab voters saw is that they went to vote, they blocked Netanyahu from forming his right-wing government, and they had a chance to really have an influence on Israeli politics. But what happened then is that Netanyahu started his delegitimization campaign against Gantz using the support of the joint list. Several members of Gantz's party were right-wing, just said that they're not willing to sit in a government that is supported by Arab politicians, which is, again, I know this is unheard of for somebody in America. Just think if you can imagine, you know, you have a different system, but let's say someone who says that he doesn't want to be elected president in the votes of, you know, African Americans or Hispanic Americans. You know, A, no politician would say that because it's stupid politics, but B, it's just unacceptable. Blue and White decided to both be racist and politically stupid and ditched the joint list and did not, and joined Netanyahu to his government. What it did is that it basically sent a signal to Arab voters that their vote basically doesn't count because it can't change anything. And they put some of the responsibility for that on the center-left, but also some of the responsibility on their own leaders that couldn't deliver. If you add to that the normalization agreement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and Sudan and Morocco, which the joint list voted against both the agreements with the UAE and the agreement with Bahrain in the Knesset, voted against them, while the Arab voters actually supported the agreements. And in polls that were done showed that the voters of the joint list actually are very happy with those agreements because they opened them up to the Arab world. And I think the combination of those three factors got us to a point where the turnout in the Arab community in the next election will go down from 65% to 55%. And the joint list, in all the polls done, show that they're going down from 15 seats to 10 seats. They lost a third of their political power, which is quite extraordinary. And Netanyahu saw all that. And you know what his conclusion was? He said, wow, votes on the floor. Let's go take them. And Netanyahu started campaigning in the last week in the Arab communities. Netanyahu went last week twice to Arab cities obviously, the reason was to check the vaccine process in vaccination stations. But basically, it was an election campaign because when he spoke to the press, he told our voters, he said, vote for us. Does this remind you of someone? You remember Donald Trump saying to African-Americans, what have you got to lose? This is exactly what Netanyahu is doing right now. Okay? And in the last election, by the way, in America, Trump got more votes from African-Americans and Hispanics than in 2016. And this is what Netanyahu is trying to do right now. And Netanyahu wants to get between 2 to 3 seats from from Arab voters. And actually, an interesting thing was that after Netanyahu opened up to campaigning to get votes from Arab voters, all of a sudden, all of the cowards in the center left got guts and started announcing that they're including Arab Israelis in their candidates list to the Knesset. It took a Netanyahu campaign in the Arab communities for them to do it, which just actually annoyed Arab voters even more. But I think that if you, for a second, go up 30,000 feet, there is a very interesting process going on that Arab voters in these elections will probably vote in big numbers to parties who are not the joint list. And Arab voters want to influence politics in this country. Arab voters want to be part of politics in this country. They want to be part of the coalition. They want to be part of the government. And I think that this is a very positive process. And even if Netanyahu's campaign right now is very cynical and even if it's not the reason he's doing it, the result will be the legitimization of Arab voters and of Arab politicians. And this is a very positive thing for this country.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about how regional or international events are playing a role in this campaign, whether it's the start of a new U.S. administration 2 weeks from tomorrow or the normalization agreements being signed between Israel and the Arab states. I mean, you talked about the Arab parties, the joint list opposition to the normalization agreements, but how are these events influencing the campaign? Are you seeing any evidence of that or not really?
Well, you remember that before the first election and before the second election and before the third election, Netanyahu did the same trick. He went to the White House. And he got some goodies from Trump. And this time, there's somebody else in the Oval Office. So I don't think that Netanyahu will be able to go to the White House before the elections. But because of what you mentioned, the agreements with the normalization agreements with the Gulf states, Netanyahu is planning to travel sometime in the end of January, maybe the beginning of February, to the United Arab Emirates and to Bahrain. And this will obviously be one of the main points in his campaign. I put a question mark about whether the Emiratis and the Bahrainis would want him to take advantage of them for his election campaign. At the end of the day, they're not, I think that, you know, they don't want to be political football. But I think that that's what Netanyahu is planning. He's also fantasizing about a visit by the King of Morocco to Israel several weeks before the election. This is really, you know, at least in my opinion, total fantasy. I do not see the King of Morocco visiting Israel before an election. I'm not sure he will do it after the election. But again, if you ask if the normalization agreements are part of the campaign, they are, but they're part of Netanyahu's campaign. And I got to tell you something, I'm not sure that this thing gets votes. Okay? Many Israelis are happy about the normalization agreements, but it's not an issue that moves voters from side to side. And I think that also Netanyahu's campaign will be again to try and squeeze his base until the last drop, because that's what he has. He will not be able to move votes, obviously, from center, from the center or from the left to vote for him. He's trying to again squeeze his base. He managed to get 36 seats in the last elections. He will try to get, if he gets to 30, 31, he's in a very good, he will be in a very good place.
I'm going to ask a couple more questions because we have a lot of audience questions and I definitely want to get to some of those. Could you talk a little bit about the significance and explain what this is, the surplus vote agreement that was recently signed between Gideon Saar and Naftali Bennett? What is it and what does it mean?
Yeah, okay. This is one of another strange thing in our system because it's a multi-party system. According to the law, two parties can sign a surplus agreement, which means that let's say that you need 8 votes eight votes to get another seat in the Knesset. One party has 5, one party has 3. They sign the surplus agreement, and then after the election, when they count all the votes and they see that this is the number that you need, then the party that has the bigger party usually gets the surplus votes, and this can get parties another seat in the Knesset. I hope it was clear enough. It's a very complicated system, actually. Most of the people in Israel, I don't even know if they know what it means.
Last question, but before I turn to the audience, Barak, do you see any reason at all that this election will produce a more conclusive or sustainable result than the previous 3?
Most chances are that the answer to your question is no. Mm. I mean, if you really look at least according to the polls right now, we are going for a fifth election.
Fifth election.
According to the polls right now, because Netanyahu's bloc with Naftali Bennett gets 56, 57, they can't form a government, obviously. And Gideon Saar's bloc, or if he is the biggest party, let's call it the anti-Bibi bloc, gets 63, 64 on a good day. But it's 63, 64 with the joint list. So basically, you get to the same point that you were previous election. Netanyahu can't form a government, and the people on the other side don't want to form a government because they don't want to get the support of the joint list. So we're stuck. And there's one person who's very happy about it. His name is Benjamin Netanyahu. And basically, he can go on and on and on. Actually, there is a very, very far-fetched scenario, but you know, nothing is far-fetched anymore in politics in the world these days. According to the when Netanyahu and Gantz made their coalition agreement, they also changed the basic law. And according to the law, on November, Benny Gantz is the prime minister. If no other prime minister was sworn in. So there is a theoretical possibility that there's no conclusive result of the elections and we go for a fifth election, then in November, Benny Gantz will be the prime minister. I know it sounds completely nuts, but there is a scenario like that.
Wow.
And if there's one good thing about this scenario, is that it's a good deterrent for all the other political players that know that if they don't form a government, if you go for a fourth election, Benny Gantz is the prime minister.
So you're saying it's both an anti-Bibi effort and an anti-Gantz effort in this
election. Exactly. Exactly.
All right. We have a question from Moritz Zimmerman. Is there any contingency plan if the next election fails too? Is there any theoretical legal limit on new elections?
No legal limit. We can go on and on and on and on and on.
And I would just point out, it's not inexpensive to run an election, right?
Yeah.
So every time you have an election, it's what, $2 million?
No.
$10 million shekels? How much more?
It's just the election day, because we have, on an election day in Israel, there's no school, people don't go to work. It's like a holiday. So it's just election day itself costs like between 2 to 3 billion shekels to the economy, because people don't go to work and there's no schools and all of that.
We have another question. Have all of these elections eroded or strengthened Israelis' trust in their government and their democracy? Are people disillusioned by what is happening?
I think they're very much disillusioned. I think that, again, especially people in that want to see Netanyahu go. Because the people who want him to stay, most of them continue to vote for him. Okay, again, he reached his lowest point. Okay, I don't think he can go down from there. And the ultra-Orthodox are getting the same results more or less in every election. And they go with Netanyahu every time. So they're not disillusioned about anything. They're just, keep on going. But the other side, you see a lot of disillusionment. You see a lot of fatigue. You see lack of trust in the system. You see lack of trust in politicians. I mean, how a person, a voter, who doesn't want to see Netanyahu and ask himself, who am I going to vote for? All of those guys lied to me the last time. So why, what's the point? They were all going to sit with him anyway. So who can I vote for? Ironically, people would always joke and say, okay, vote for the joint list. They will never go with Netanyahu. But several months ago, one part of the joint list, the faction, the Islamic faction, which is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, okay? Just think how crazy this is. And the offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is part of the joint list, started cooperating with Netanyahu, and its leader did not rule out that they will sit in Netanyahu's government. So ironically, even people who voted for the joint list got their vote stolen.
Jason Berkovich asks, how likely is it for an anti-Netanyahu coalition to form between left and right? Are there any housing, economic, education policies, et cetera, which could unite such a coalition aside from their opposition to Bibi?
Yeah. So again, what you hear from both Naftali Bennett and Gideon Saar, who are trying to court center-left voters, they're saying, Naftali Bennett says it very clearly, he says, I want to form a government for 2 years that will only deal with economic recovery and COVID. And put aside all the left-right arguments about the Supreme Court, about church and state, about settlements, about annexation. Put all of those things aside, deal with economic recovery and COVID. Gideon Saar is not saying that, but he's giving a version. Because first he's saying that he's not going to sit with Netanyahu. And by that, this is one thing that everybody that is to the left of Netanyahu agrees, that he shouldn't be the prime minister. So this is a unifying factor. And secondly, he also says we need to focus reunite the country, recover the economy, take care of COVID. Reminds you of someone, okay? This is how Joe Biden tried to get Republican voters to vote for him. He gave a very, very center message. And also, I think it's a bit, you know, it's a bit funny, but Gideon Saar is trying to portray the fact that he chose his number two, a member of Knesset, a very talented member of Knesset, whose name is Yifat Shasha Biton. She used to be part of Moshe Kahlon's party called Kulanu. Nobody even remembers such a thing even existed, and it was only a year ago. So when they joined forces, and she joined him as number two, he said that she will be the vice prime minister if he's elected. And when people said, how can she be vice prime minister? She's only been a member of Knesset for 3 years or 4 years. He said, look, I'm doing, you know, Joe Biden appointed, took, you know, Kamala Harris as his running mate. I'm taking Yifat Shasha Biton. Both of them are strong, talented, impressive women. And so she will have no problem being the vice prime minister. And this is also, if you want to look at it as a similarity to your politics.
So this is actually related to the next question. Leora Moriel asks, why is there no women's party? And what about the significance that no party is led by a woman, although you just mentioned Yifat being the number two? And
yeah, but it's a good question, because up until not so long, we had three parties that were led by women. Okay. In the 2013 election, we had three parties led by women. We had Tzipi Livni heading the party that was called The Movement. We had Shelly Yachimovich as the head of the Labor Party. We had Zehava Galon as the head of Meretz. Now there is no party that is led by women. And actually, in the last three elections, there was a decrease in the number of women in the Israeli Knesset and in the Israeli government. I think that many parties figured out that it was a mistake. And now you see that Gideon Saar's party is going to be half men, half women. Ron Huldai also announced today that his party will be half men, half women. Yair Lapid's party is going to have more women than it used to have. So I think you see some sort of effort to fix this situation. But still, the fact that no women are heading parties is very unfortunate.
Julian Letterman asks, as it looks like Bibi is backed more and more into a corner, he arguably becomes more dangerous. And that sounds very familiar on this side of the ocean. What are you most scared of that he will try to do? If annexation is no longer feasible, how will he desperately try to get people to stick with him?
Actually, I don't think he's going to do anything dangerous because of the elections, because it's mainly because Joe Biden is going to be in the Oval Office from January 20th. So it will be, you know, almost impossible to do anything, at least on foreign policy, or that is, you know, very radical. But the problem is not what's going to happen before the election. The problem is when we'll get the magic number of 61 and get a majority in the Knesset. Because then it's pretty obvious that the fact that Netanyahu needs such a majority, and the fact that he's willing to go on and on and on and on for election campaigns, maybe a fifth one, is for one reason: the fact that he's on trial for three corruption charges. And he needs to get to 61 in order to find a way to stop his trial, either through passing a law that will stop the trial, either through firing the attorney general, He needs a government decision in order for that to happen. He can't do it himself. Either through other legal tricks, like a bill, like a law that will enable the Knesset to bypass Supreme Court rulings, which is something that is, you know, we don't have in this country. So if you're talking about dangerous things that Netanyahu can do, I'm more concerned about what he can do if he gets to 61, not what he can do until the elections, because at least it seems for now that his line is not going to be this time another, you know, racist, inflammatory campaign.
Barak, we have a few questions on annexation. I'm going to combine them. And as you know, Israel Policy Forum was the first organization on this side of the ocean to talk about the dangers of West Bank annexation going back 3 years. So this is certainly an important issue to us as an organization. William Daroff refers to your comment that annexation is dead. Do you mean that in the context of annexation as an election issue, or do you also mean it's dead vis-a-vis the next government's policies? And let me add to that Alan Luxenberg's question. He's asking, is annexation truly off the table? Aren't Saar and Bennett both pro-annexation? And even if formal annexation's off the table, isn't creeping annexation still very much a reality?
So first, I'm happy to see that my friend William Daroff is with us from the Conference of Presidents. It's I have to tell you that if there's one person that I'm happy that he is where he is William. And thanks, William, for being with us. And when I said that annexation is dead, it's as a campaign promise, of course, but also as a government policy. There's no annexation when Joe Biden is in the White House. Every politician that I asked, and this includes Bennett and Gideon Saar, they all acknowledge that it's not feasible, and that you cannot move forward with annexation when you have you know, a president like Joe Biden in the White House. Creeping annexation, obviously, this is something that's been going on for years, and I don't think it's going to stop. And the question is whether it is going to slow down. This, the answer to this question is yet to be determined, because we need to see what is going to be the Biden administration's policy on Israel-Palestine, how much they're willing to deal with this issue, and how much they are willing to either fight with the government here over this, or to just say, you know what, we're not going to fight with you, but we're also not going to protect you or protect your settlement policy, annexation policy in international forums, the UN Security Council, so on and so forth. Right now, at least my feeling is that the incoming administration is, let's say, doesn't have any appetite to deal with this issue. I think they will roll back some of Trump's policies, but nothing more than that. And if the Israeli government doesn't do anything very extreme, they will basically deal with an administration that will deal with settlements and annexation mainly in the State Department daily briefing.
So I think our audience is also sort of trying to figure out what the various combinations might be of a government that could defeat Netanyahu. So we have a question here. If Meretz joins a coalition with Gideon Saar and Bennett and Lieberman and Huldai, they could theoretically make a government, an anti-BB bloc. Do you think it's possible?
Well, the answer to this question is if you think that you can get AOC, Mitt Romney, Bill Kristol, and Bernie together to get Trump out of office. I'm not an expert in U.S. politics, but my answer to this would be yes, they would do it. Okay, Bernie and AOC would cooperate with Mitt Romney and Bill Kristol to get Trump out. And for the same reason, I think that the problem is not whether Meretz and Huldai and Yair Lapid will cooperate with Bennett and Gideon Saar. The question is, and this is actually the only question, is whether Naftali Bennett will agree to cooperate with Gideon Saar and everybody who are left of Gideon Saar. That's the, because if he is ready to do it, then Netanyahu is not the next prime minister. My personal opinion, Bennett is not there. He is still hostage of his psychological complexes with Bibi, and he's still a hostage of, you know, radical messianic elements within the right wing, who are committed to Netanyahu and therefore will not allow him to do such a thing.
So turning to vaccination, which, as you know, Barak, is going much better in Israel than any place else in the world. And I can tell you, I'm very jealous of all my Israeli friends who keep telling me they're getting vaccinated. We have no idea when we're going to even see it. What about this extremely efficient approach to vaccination? The Israeli response has been incredible. Will people want to vote for Bibi because of that?
I think that this is what Netanyahu is betting on. That's going to be main part of his campaign. But I got to tell you that the first batch of the vaccines is over. I think that 70% of people above the age of 60 were already vaccinated, and you don't see any influence on the polls. So the main group of people who are in danger are vaccinated, and you don't see any change in the polls. And on the other hand, the government just decided an hour ago to go for a general complete lockdown in the whole country for at least 2 weeks. And there's no chance that it's just going to be 2 weeks. It's going to be at least three, maybe four. So this gets you already to February. And general lockdown means more people that are unemployed, more parents who are going crazy because their kids don't go to school. And for now, at least, the numbers just today, I think we had more than 8,000 new cases of COVID. And it was something around 7% of all tests came back positive. Just think about what this number means in America, 7%. You're talking about, think that, you know, again, you're in this situation right now. But I think it's even worse than the situation in America is right now, the percentage of positive tests. So again, Netanyahu will try to use the vaccinations. In February, there will be a second batch of vaccinations. He hopes to get as many people possible vaccinated. And hopefully he hopes to somehow open up the country before the elections, so people will feel, oh, we're both vaccinated and the economy is going back. But at least from the way the cabinet meeting went today and the numbers that we're seeing, it's not that easy. It's not that easy. So, but it will be very interesting to see how this goes.
Indeed. This has been a terrific hour.
And by the way, just another comment on the vaccinations. Yeah. People in America ask me all the time, how did this happen? How did so many people get vaccinated so fast? And here in America, everything is so slow. And the main reason the main reason has to do with something that happened here 100 years ago, even before the country was established. The one thing that the Jewish population in mandatory Palestine did is that it opened up what we call Kupot Cholim. It's like national health providers. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we established those 100 years ago, and they basically developed with the development of the country, and it's a community health service that you have a community clinic almost in every two or three blocks, you have a community clinic. So people can go to the community clinics right next door to get vaccinated. And it's the community clinic they go every time they have a problem. And obviously they are all also have medical insurance, which is, I know it's a big issue in your country, but so the combination between the fact that there's from day one of this country, people had medical insurance, and from day one, they had community health providers. The combination between those two gets us to where we are today.
That's a really important point. Thank you for making that. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. Barak, thank you so much for taking
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
We really appreciate it, and we'll certainly have you back. Once again, I want to thank our supporters who are with us on today's call. Your generosity makes programs like this one possible. Again, if you've not yet done so, please consider making a contribution today at israelpolicyforum.org/giving. I encourage you all to subscribe to our podcast, Israel Policy Pod, sign up to receive the weekly Koplo column in your email inbox, and visit our website to access recordings of our previous briefings. Our next video briefing, which will take place next Tuesday, January 12th, at 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific, will focus on a recent task force report issued by the Center for New American Security that offers a blueprint to the incoming Biden administration for a new U.S. strategy regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Our panelists will be the co-authors of the report, our very own policy director, Michael Koplo, along with Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, a senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and Ilan Goldenberg, senior fellow and director of the Middle East Security Program at CNS. Remember, if it's Tuesday, it's an IPF webinar. So thank you all for joining us once again. And Barak, hamon toda. Erev tov. Thank you.